The Courage to Rest, Thomas Aquinas on the Soul of Leisure. Whenever the topic of leisure comes up in conversation, whether in the classroom or among friends, inevitably someone will ask the question, "Have you read Pieper's essay?" The question is inevitable because, in conversations about leisure, it is exactly the right question to ask. For 70 years now, Joseph Pieper's Leisure, The Basis of Culture, has exemplified what discussion of leisure as a perfective human activity should be. In order to clarify their thinking on the subject, professors, students, and the general reader still rely on Pieper's account, his succinct and compelling account of the nature of leisure, as well as his correction of any number of erroneous notions of human rest that we might entertain. With Thomas Aquinas as his guide, Pieper resists the modern tendency to regard leisure simply as the cessation of work, or worse, to equate leisure with sloth. Instead, Pieper emphasizes leisure's nature as an activity, not a lack of one, and as a joyful celebration of reality, not a sorrowful retreat from it. What I'd like to do this evening in celebration of the essay's 70th anniversary is to review Pieper's description of leisure, but with a view to expanding it. With Thomas Aquinas as our guide, I want to build on Pieper's description of leisure by exploring in greater detail than he does the soul of leisure, or better, the soul capable of leisure. We will conclude that, in addition to being a soul receptive of reality, as Pieper notes the leisurely soul to be, the soul of leisure courageously dreams big dreams, and it does so humbly. When he writes Leisure, The Basis of Culture, 1947, Pieper has a particular end in view. He recalls the Aristotelian Thomistic doctrine of leisure in order to combat the modern and what Pieper calls the totalitarian view of work. This view exaggerates the importance of work in human life, making work or labor the whole for which and in which all human activity takes place. Max Weber describes the modern notion of work like this: one does not work to live, one lives to work. Pieper opposes this notion of work, noting that it corrupts not only our understanding of human industry, but also our understanding of human epistemology and human morality. For example, in the realm of epistemology, Pieper observes how the totalitarian notion of work corrupts Immanuel Kant's theory of human knowing. For Kant, Pieper explains, reason is all work. It indulges in no play. All reasoning is striving. Nothing known, according to Kant, is received or gained by resting. Similarly, the totalitarian notion of work corrupts our understanding of morality. It turns all moral activity into pure striving. It is normal and essential, Pieper writes when articulating the totalitarian view of morality, that the effort of will required in forcing oneself to perform some action should become the yardstick, the measure of the moral good. In other words, the more difficult the thing is, the higher it is in the order of goodness. In the realm of doing, as in the realm of knowing, all is work, according to the totalitarian view. The moral man indulges in no play. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, the old adage says. The same holds true for the totalitarian view of work. All work and no play makes knowing and loving dull activities. Pieper warns his reader that when the totalitarian view of work exaggerates the importance of labor, and by extension reduces thinking and loving to pure striving, then something like leisure begins to appear as something vicious, if not completely monstrous. From the totalitarian point of view, Pieper writes, leisure appears as something wholly fortuitous and strange, without rhyme or reason, and morally speaking, unseemly. Leisure becomes another word for laziness, idleness, and sloth. In his essay, Pieper employs the classical and medieval notion of leisure to rehabilitate our understanding of all three of these areas of human activity: industry, knowing, and loving. Against the modern notion of labor, according to which one does not work to live, one lives to work, Pieper proposes Aristotle's view that we are unleisurely in order to have leisure. Against the modern epistemology of Kant, which sees knowing as a Herculean task, Pieper recalls the classical distinction between ratio and intellectus. Ratio denotes our discursive thinking, in which we form knowledge through intellectual activity, namely composing and dividing intellectual species and comparing and contrasting them. Intellectus denotes our understanding, which is a more passive activity, in which we grasp reality more by receiving forms than by producing thoughts. The human possession of intellectus, distinct from ratio, means that the highest form of our knowing involves not acting so much as it involves resting. Finally, against the modern notion of moral living as something strictly arduous, Pieper recalls Aquinas' teaching that the essence of virtue consists in the good rather than in the difficult, and that in Pieper's words, the sublime achievements of moral goodness are characterized by effortlessness because it is of their essence to spring from love. Here Pieper recalls Aquinas' teaching that virtuous action is not difficult, slow, and doleful, but rather easy, prompt, and joyful. In order to correct the totalitarian notion of leisure as idleness or sloth, Pieper describes leisure not according to its external appearance, but according to its interior reality, or better, according to the interior qualities of the human soul necessary for a man to be at leisure. These qualities could not be more removed from idleness and sloth. Rather than being merely physically at rest or spiritually immobile as the idle and the slothful are, the man at leisure is, Pieper says, at one with himself. What Pieper means by this is that the leisurely man acquiesces in his own being. For Pieper, to acquiesce in one's own being is not a physical activity as much as it is a spiritual one. Leisure, therefore, is not determined by material factors external to the person, like spare time, a holiday, a weekend, a vacation. Instead, leisure results from the convergence of spiritual factors within the person. It is, Pieper says, an attitude of mind, a condition of soul. Leisure is a form of silence. That is not only the occasion, but also the capacity for steeping oneself in the whole of creation. The leisurely man is not an idle machine, but a soul at rest in reality. More precisely, Pieper explains, the leisurely man is at rest interiorly, intellectually and appetitively, with the world around him. Pieper is quick to clarify that the interior rest of leisure is not just any resting. For example, leisure is not a resting in which one turns inward in order to look after some need, To the contrary, leisure is a resting in which one turns outward in order to look with delight at the world. Leisure is a resting in which one takes contemplative delight at being and in being. Leisure draws its vitality from affirmation, Pieper writes, an affirmation of existence. Again, Pieper underscores that leisure is not, quote, the same as non-activity, nor is it identical with tranquility. Rather, Pieper continues, leisure is like the tranquil silence of lovers, which draws its strength from concord. According to Pieper, one achieves the rest of leisure through entering into an intellectual and appetitive union with the world outside of the self. In leisure, man achieves a contemplative union with the whole of being. When at true rest, the human individual celebrates the end of his work by allowing his inner eye to dwell for a while upon the reality of God's creation. Pieper says that man at leisure looks at and affirms the world, and like God, man declares, it is good. For Pieper, then, leisure is the kind of rest proper to the rational animal. It's the kind of rest proper to the human creature. Leisure is not merely a physical resting from labor, as a dog may rest after chasing a squirrel. Leisure is an intellectual resting in reality. Accordingly, Pieper warns that no one who looks to leisure simply to restore his working powers will ever discover the fruit of leisure. In other words, the end of leisure is not the recuperation of one's physical strength, though this may result from leisure. Pieper observes that when the rational animal rests his body from the toils of labor, he still retains his intellectual powers, to which belongs an intellectual form of resting. This resting is not the cessation of reason and understanding, as physical resting involves the cessation of movement. To the contrary, the intellect's resting involves some activity, which is contemplative in nature. When the intellect rests, it rests in the understanding of that which it naturally seeks, the whole of reality. Because when at rest, man retains the faculty of grasping the world as a whole, Pieper writes, then it is at leisure, when free from distraction, that man can actualize his full potentialities as an entity meant to reach wholeness. For Pieper, the leisurely reach for wholeness includes the human reach for God. This is because man's leisurely resting in reality, which reaches out intellectually for reality's wholeness, includes an affirmation as well as a celebration of reality. As affirming and celebrating reality, Pieper says, leisure seeks to affirm and celebrate also the divine origin of reality. Thus, according to Pieper, does leisure find its perfection ultimately in divine worship. Leisure achieves its true purpose when it equips the human individual to fulfill the third commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. If we step back from Pieper's argument in Leisure, the Basis of Culture, and examine his logic apart from his polemic with the totalitarian view of work, we will recognize that Pieper describes leisure according to the perfections of man's rational powers, both his intellect and his will. In other words, Pieper describes leisure as an activity of the perfected intellect, insofar as through the virtues of wisdom, understanding, and knowledge, man grasps intellectually the whole of reality. Pieper also describes leisure as an activity of the perfected will, insofar as through the virtue of justice, especially religion, man renders God the worship that he is owed. Pieper argues beneath the surface of his text, therefore, that the leisurely man is the virtuous man. But the portrait that he paints of the leisurely man, at least in terms of the leisurely man's virtue, remains incomplete. Pieper depicts leisure as an activity possible to one with a virtuously perfected intellect and will. But what of the virtuously perfected passions? Does courage and temperance, like justice, inform the activity of leisure? Pieper does not say. Pieper's silence on this question does not mean that his description of leisure is wrong, of course. It just means that, perhaps, it's incomplete, at least in terms of describing how all of the moral virtues together contribute to the rendering of an individual capable of leisure. And what remains of this talk, I propose to indicate how Thomas Aquinas' doctrine of courage and temperance can help us to complete the portrait of the leisurely man that Pieper begins. Let us start with the virtue of courage. Courage equips a man for leisure in a very particular way. It equips a man for leisure by making him magnanimous, which means literally big-souled. According to Aquinas, magnanimity is that virtuous quality of soul by which the soul stretches itself out to great and difficult things. As a part of courage, magnanimity contributes to the attaining of great things by fortifying the passion of hope, which passion stirs when a future good becomes visible to us but remains difficult to attain. Magnanimity is that virtue we require in order to strive for great things after the difficulty of their attainment becomes apparent to us. Aquinas explains that the great things that magnanimity seeks are the great deeds made possible by the virtues. These great deeds require great attention, and our performance of them can be slow and deliberate. Magnanimity, therefore, strives not just for what is good and virtuous, but for what is excellent and virtuous. The magnanimous man seeks to know not just the truth, but the highest truths. The magnanimous man seeks to love not just the good, but the highest goods. As a form of courage, magnanimity guards the passion of hope. The passion of hope for the highest and best things, and keeps hope virtuous. Magnanimity holds hope firmly within the rule of reason, so that hope does not turn vicious and become presumptuous, ambitious, or vainglorious. In terms of leisure, therefore, magnanimity becomes a prerequisite virtue insofar as leisure rests in the understanding of the highest things knowable and in the love of the highest things lovable. To know the highest thing, namely the whole of being, is difficult. To love the highest reality, namely God, is difficult. Courage is required to strive for this knowledge and love. Magnanimity is the particular form of courage necessary to pursue and to rest in the highest truth accessible to human wisdom and the highest good accessible to human justice. Magnanimity renders the pursuit of these difficult goods easy, prompt, and joyful. As a form of courage, magnanimity is assisted in its pursuit of leisure by the virtue of temperance, particularly in the form of humility. Pieper makes this observation in his famous essay on temperance. Humility and magnanimity, he writes, not only are not mutually exclusive, they actually are neighbors and are akin to each other. This is St. Thomas's own view. Aquinas writes in the Summa Theologiae that in regard to the difficult good, two virtues are needed. Magnanimity, as a form of courage, strengthens the passions, particularly hope, in the pursuit of great things. But in the pursuit of great things, another virtue becomes necessary, namely temperance, in the form of modesty, in order, quote, to temper and restrain the mind, Aquinas writes, lest the mind tend to high things immoderately. This tempering and restraining of the mind is the work of a particular form of modesty, which is humility. For St. Thomas, therefore, magnanimity and humility each have their part to play in keeping the human pursuit of great things reasonable. He writes, humility restrains the appetite from aiming at great things against right reason, while magnanimity urges the mind to great things in accord with right reason. Hence, it is clear that magnanimity is not opposed to humility. Indeed, they concur in this, that each is according to right reason. Humility, as a virtue shaping the concupiscible appetite, puts a check on the irascible passion of hope, which itself is perfected by magnanimity, so that magnanimous hope, which undergirds the activity of leisure, does not veer into the realm of pride. Accordingly, humility inserts reason into appetite by maintaining in the magnanimous individual a proper reverence both for God and for his providence for man. Humility ensures that the hopeful man does not, in the words of Aquinas, ascribe to himself more than is competent to him according to the position which God has placed him. Humility, therefore, keeps the magnanimous striving after great things from becoming impetuous. Humility ensures that the magnanimous man does not foolishly reach beyond the limits of his nature and seek after, in the words of the psalmist, things too great or marvels beyond us. Humility directs the striving of magnanimity toward the great things to which man is actually made to attain, which includes the grasping of the whole of reality and a peaceful and festive resting in it. Like magnanimity, humility is a prerequisite virtue for leisure. With St. Thomas as our guide, we have expanded on Pieper's description of leisure. To Pieper's explanation that leisure involves the perfection of the intellectual virtues, especially wisdom, and of the moral virtue of justice, namely religion, we have added how the other two moral virtues, courage and temperance, particularly through magnanimity and humility, also contribute to the activity of leisure. Magnanimity gives man the courage to strive after the highest things, to apply his mind to the difficult task of knowing the whole of reality. And it is humility that keeps man receptive in his striving. Humility keeps the magnanimous man open to the whole of reality, as God has made it, to rest finally in what is as a gift, and not to supplant God's providence with his own. The soul of leisure, therefore, is not only wise and religious, as Pieper says, but also, as Aquinas helps us to see, magnanimous and humble. Thank you. No word yet on the Supreme Court pick. So we have some time for questions. If you have a question, raise your hand. I'll identify you and do my best to answer. Ah, there's a mic coming around.
So after we work to understand this, you know, from a sort of heady point of view, what would you recommend from a pastoral point of view to help cultivate this reality in our lives?
Well, certainly it's to cultivate, you know, all of the virtues in the particular circumstances in which, you know, we find ourselves, to hold the virtues up as not ideal so much as real realities that you know, that perfect us. I mean, for preaching, I mean, that means Sunday after Sunday, I mean, talking about prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude, and to give concrete examples, you know, like the leisurely man, the magnanimous man, to hold them up as examples. I mean, Aristotle is right. I mean, you want to know what the virtuous, how to live, you know, the virtues. I mean, you just look at the virtuous man, I mean, the person who has those virtues. And so, you know, a lot of teaching is by illustration, by giving examples, and pointing, you know, particular instances of where virtuous activity can save us, I mean, from certainly vicious activity, but just to point us in the right direction in life.
At the end of your lecture, you were talking about how humility keeps magnanimous man from overreaching.
Right.
And from, you know, not daring for things beyond our grasp.
Right.
If leisure is resting in the whole of being, mm-hmm. what could be beyond that?
Sure.
And if leisure is religious and it's wise, if we're to rest in the divine, the whole of being, what is humility keeping us in check from?
Right. On the one hand, a grasping at the whole of reality instead of a reception of it, you know, as something given. I mean, there are lots of patristic and even medieval commentators of scripture who see that was essentially at the heart of the angelic fall. You know, it was a grasping at beatitude without, you know, receiving it as a grace, something given. Christ, in his humility, comes and counters that, you know, as we read in the great hymn of Christ, you know, canonic love, that though he's in the form of God, Jesus did not grasp at equality, or did not cling to his equality as something to be grasped at, but it's just something given, something that's his by certainly his own divine nature, but not something that he himself makes. And I think that's the other part of what I think humility keeps us from doing. It's to kind of claiming for ourselves certain divine prerogatives, like creating, and also judging. You know, we can be tempted to think that you know, the leisure that comes to us as a gift is a product of our own doing, and that's part of what Pieper sees is the one of the errors at the heart of the totalitarian notion of work, is that it's this kind of idolization of the work of our hands. So Aquinas, I mean, if you, for more, you can look at Aquinas' question on humility, where he makes this point specifically, that humility keeps man in check, in striving for great things, from claiming for himself certain of the divine prerogatives, namely creating. And I would add judging, among other things. All the way in the back there.
I think you've alluded to this, but I guess I'll just be a little more direct. Do you think that our society, whether intentionally or unintentionally, conspires to prevent us from enjoying leisure? So much, it seems like one of the prerequisites for enjoying leisure is time. Mm-hmm. And especially, I mean, here in this city, and I think throughout the country, where,
right.
You know, we bring all sorts of socioeconomic factors into that if you want, but do you see us living in a culture in which leisure is kind of disencouraged, and what do you think,
right.
What steps do you think we should take to change that sort of society or that culture?
Yeah. I think part of the problem you can see is something like when people retire, you know, that all of a sudden they have lots of time and simply don't know what to do with it. And they get completely bored. Lots of people I know who did retire end up working again, you know, because they just don't know what to do with their time. I mean, I think that has something to do with our inability simply to keep the Sabbath rest. So, I mean, it's not just a question of having time, of being inactive, of being idle, of allowing the body to rest, you know, as I said, to recoup our powers in order just simply to return back to work. That there's something else that goes on, you know, in leisure. And it's something that we have to be taught, and it has to be explained to us, it has to be modeled for us. So if it, you know, doesn't happen in the home, you know, if we don't, you know, learn it growing up, it's going to be hard to kind of discover it, you know, later as adults when, in fact, we're thrown into the world of work without that ability to rest, kind of the contemplative gaze of what is. And different people are going to be able to enter into that gaze, I mean, at different levels. So, I mean, it's not like this kind of one monolithic kind of gaze for everyone. No, it's an art to be learned and not just, yeah. So I don't think it's just a question of being given the time or finding oneself idle, but developing the inner qualities, the perfecting of the intellectual virtues, the perfecting of our intellectual powers to do what we're made to do as capable of universal knowledge. It's to know things universally. And to rest in that knowledge, which for people that elicits, you know, reactions of affirmation and celebration. One of the things that Pieper points to in his essay is you can judge a culture's ability to engage in leisure to the degree that it celebrates festivals well. You know, that it's not just kind of a celebration of the cessation of work, but that you actually rejoice. You stop working and rejoice in something else. And that festival, you know, finds its perfection for Pieper in the liturgy, in the sacrifice of the Mass, the festival of the praise of God, that is the Eucharistic sacrifice. But also, you have civic festivals that that celebrate the goodness of creation. And if a culture finds itself unable to do that well, I mean, just think of what our St. Patrick's Day celebrations have turned into, Mardi Gras. You know, all of these had religious roots, and yet they're just kind of public excuses now for kind of debauchery. yeah, it shows that we have lost a sense culturally of what it means to engage in true leisure, which means to affirm and to celebrate the goods of reality soberly, but still festive. Questions. Back here, and then there's another one up here up front.
You sort of touched on the moral virtues, and I think in a few ways on, as I count it, two of the three theological virtues. You kind of touched on hope and love. Could you speak a bit to faith's role in the formation of
right.
leisure? And, might it have something to do with the epistemological question of what is it that we're grasping or resting
right.
in?
Right. When I talked about hope and love here, is really on the more on the natural level. You know, the love as desire, simple desire for the good, and hope as the passion, you know, for the difficult good. But yes, they also have their theological expressions in faith, hope, and charity. And to answer your question specifically, I mean, faith insofar as it gives a certain knowledge of God. It would seem then that faith makes the acquisition of leisure easier, you know, because the perfection of the intellect comes with revelation given. It's not something that, not a science that we have to kind of investigate and develop ourselves, you know, through arduous study of created things, but in revelation, which we also have to study to acquire, you know, deeper understandings of. But with the gift of faith comes certain knowledge of God and of the things of God. And there is, in prayer, in contemplation, in meditation, in the celebration of the Mass, kind of a festive resting, you know, in that truth, which is, you know, at least according to Pieper's definition, the very definition of the very essence of leisure. So faith certainly, you know, would contribute concretely, you know, to the pursuit of leisure. And we have a question up front.
I can't remember if Pieper mentions leisure in relation to public life, but I know Aristotle talks about public life and the political life being something that one can do when one has leisure. I was wondering if you could speak to the relation between leisure and the public life, and if it's not too much to also perhaps relate that to the current easily manifested way of participating in public life, as in following the news that is more just vitriolic,
right,
flame throwing at,
right,
one side to another, like Hollywood Gossip magazine.
Right. It's a nice way to put it. Insofar as the common good is one of the great goods, it's one of the high goods, one of the goods difficult to attain, you know, we would hope that our politicians, you know, who are given the privilege, you know, to govern, you know, to contribute to the common good by governing it, would be magnanimous, you know, in the sense of they're given, they possess the courage, you know, to possess, to pursue that arduous good from a contemplative point of view, not simply a practical or utilitarian point of view, but one that's contemplative, that our politicians are people who can appreciate the goodness of the polity in and of itself as something that's perfective, you know, of all of the citizens that form, you know, the polity, the common good. Not sure that requires every politician to be a philosopher king, but it's just somebody who, you know, can appreciate contemplatively the good of the whole, which is a hard good to attain and maintain. And for those of us who aren't, you know, politicians, but who follow politics and are engaged, we vote, you know, we engage in debate. Yeah, it's to leave behind just kind of the tit-for-tat arguing and enter into that contemplative gaze of the whole also. You know, I think that's, you know, to love the common good, even as a citizen, means to love it commonly, to love it as something shareable, that it's not just for me, and it's not just the city's not simply instrumental to my own personal flourishing, but that as an individual, I flourish within it, as a part and a whole. And that takes some time to understand. I mean, that can shape, you know, our meditation on human life and our political life, and hopefully shape the conversation then that's ruled by our esteem for the good to be gained by our common work together, and not just simply something I argue because it benefits me, you know, in a particular way. So both politicians and citizens alike, you know, there's something kind of this leisurely gaze at the good of the whole, of the common good, that should shape our politics, both the governance of our leaders and the support that we give to them, you know, by our public debate.
Thank you very much. I think I understand or have a glimpse of what the kind of leisure you're talking about, if I'm thinking of it in the context of an individual's prayer life or contemplative life.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if you can comment a bit on what this kind of leisure looks like in our relations with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, especially when you think of the virtue of generosity,
mm-hmm,
once you are looking at outwards, or once you return outwards in your relationship with other people and being truly generous, that might manifest itself in what looks like work. And I'm thinking particularly, I think this might be something that's very important for women, since often throughout history, women's work has been heavier or more so in the home. And that's also where the place of leisure is. So I think the line between work and rest is not so clearly delineated in some cases. So what does, do we still need to have a careful distinction between work and rest once we bring in this component of serving other people? And what would that distinction look like? Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think part of it is to understand, when we look at the four moral virtues, especially prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude, and all of their individual parts, it's really to get an understanding of how all the parts fit together. And that's that contributes to our understanding of the unity of the virtues. And so what I tried to do here tonight was just to show how the lower moral virtues, those that deal with the passions, conspire, to the support of the higher virtues of justice and of the perfection of the intellectual virtues. That's, you find Aquinas, talking about that over and over again. And I just tried to give one example, here. It's not to say, though, that other moral virtues don't come into play or that our leisure doesn't strengthen our exercise of the other virtues, especially those of justice, as we live in community with each other. Certainly part of, the contemplative gaze that we should have and the contemplative appreciation of the common good, is something that we share with others. And then therefore, when I see the common good as something shareable, that should shape the way I look at my neighbor and should shape my desire to not only live with my neighbor, but to pursue the common good with him or her, whether that's in the home or in the city. And certainly other virtues would come in play there and kind of perfecting, our relations with each other. As far as kind of keeping rest and work distinct, there are areas of overlap. It's in day in and day out, it's going to be hard to, identify exactly, if this is kind of a restful work or kind of a working rest or, something like that. And we see it in the scriptures too, in the Gospels. The Christ's visit to Bethany, when his encounter with Martha and Mary. Also, the numerous times in which we see the Lord pull the apostles aside, from the work of preaching, from the work of teaching the crowd, simply to be alone together, away from that specific work. I see more of kind of a clear distinction there. I would avoid things, like my work is my prayer, type of thing. I think that confuses things a little too much, because there actually is real prayer that's not work, and there's real work that's, not prayer. Even though in certain circumstances the two can be brought together. I don't know if that is helpful. We had a question up here in the middle of the room.
The answer to this is probably just a simple both and. But okay. I'm just wondering if leisure is ever something that should be pursued in and of itself, or if it's just kind of like a happy result of our pursuit of other virtues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's something to be pursued. As a perfective activity, it's something that should be sought, for itself. And not just the result of the other virtues. My rendering a debt that I owe to you, I can enjoy, being, restored to justice. The balance of justice is restored between us, but that doesn't immediately launch me into leisure, to kind of contemplative, gaze at the whole of reality. So it is something that's distinct from simply living virtuously. It is its own goal and to be sought. The virtues are necessary for them, but it's not equated just with virtuous living.
Final question.
One more.
Your presentation was generally an aspirational and positive one, but at risk of seeming flippant with your title, is there a kind of cowardice to busyness? And if so, what is being feared in this kind of perpetual busyness?
Yeah, I think just what Pieper says, being at home with the self, and kind of acquiescing, kind of resting, you know, in being, as something given, you know, because for any number of reasons, I mean, that could be kind of a test case. I mean, is Pieper right that that we all, to one degree or another, we've adopted the totalitarian notion of work? We do think that what we are and our worth is the result of our own production, you know, that we make ourselves. All of our knowledge is self-made, you know, all of our goodness, you know, is self-made. And to rely on another, in one who in fact is higher than we are, to give us better goods, is something in sin we're just not very comfortable with. and we're suspicious of it. For various reasons, but I think that's one of the diseases, the spiritual diseases that's healed, hopefully, you know, in conversion, through grace, to recognize that that even our being, you know, something as simple as that, our mere existence, is just something given, you know, a gift, and to live that way. Maybe that's what we're scared of. We'd rather live as if all of this was of our making. I think that's how I'd answer that. Thank you again.